Sports.
Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live
and what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW.
No one knows San Francisco better than writer and historian Gary Camilla. And on tonight's show, we'll talk to him about his latest book, Spirits of San Francisco, and the newly published anthology, The End of the Golden Gate, to which he contributed an essay.
And then we'll hear Grace's interview with Bay Area poet Giovanna Lomanto. But first, let's check in on the state of the 980 freeway.
With Biden's new infrastructure bill on the decks, cities and states across the country are hoping to get money for projects that have been languishing. One proposal that is getting more attention is the idea to demolish the 980 freeway and replace it with a roadway that would connect West Oakland to downtown.
With us to talk about this proposal are East Bay Times reporter Nico Savage and Chris Sensenig, founder of Connect Oakland. So Nico and Chris, welcome so much to State of the Bay. And Nico, I wanted to start with you. Could you just help orient us? Where does the 980 freeway begin and where does it end? It looks like we have some audio trouble here. So I'm going to just see if we can hear from either Nico or Chris. Do we have either of you?
Well, it looks like we're having a little bit of audio problems, but Ethan, you know a little bit about 980, so tell us where it's located.
Well, as our East Bay host, as part of State of the Bay, I'm happy to provide some of this context, although I know that Chris and Nico could do so. But for those of you who are not familiar, 980 is the freeway that essentially bisects downtown Oakland from West Oakland. As I recall, it was built in, I believe, in the 1970s, somewhere around then. And it's basically a way to get people from east of Oakland to get through Oakland and then into areas like the airport and Oakland Coliseum, if you're an A's fan, such as I am. And a lot of residents have been upset because the problem with the 980 freeway is that it essentially bisects downtown from the West Oakland community. And so I'm really excited to hear from Nico and Chris on this. But part of the potential opportunity here, if you were to essentially remove the freeway, would be to create a surface street and have the cars transition to surface street vehicles through Oakland, but allowing for reconnecting those two parts of Oakland. You would allow for a pedestrian walkway or bicycle access, and it could really help bring
Hello.
West Oakland back into the fold for Oakland. So so that's the potential upside here, which is why we're excited to have Nico and Chris, and I know they're we're getting their audio fixed, so I appreciate everyone standing by. But it is potentially a very controversial project if it's preventing access from folks who are east of Oakland. And also, as a potential upside, as we think about what happened with the Embarcadero Freeway, for example, in San Francisco, where when the Embarcadero Freeway was removed, then you opened up a whole new neighborhood. Or think of what happened in Hayes Valley, removing that that overpass that used to go right into Hayes and is now turned over into a pedestrian access point. So this would be part of that. Of course, it would not be earthquake-induced like what happened with the Embarcadero Freeway, but it could be a potential way to bring back the neighborhood in Oakland and essentially bring back some urban vitality once again to downtown Oakland. So that I think, is the thinking. We'll hear more from Chris on it once they can get on board. One thing I would say is that I am curious what listeners have to say about this, especially for those in the East Bay, what your thoughts might be on whether or not it makes sense to get rid of the 980 freeway and turn it into a surface street. And you can call 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, if you wanted to weigh in whether you think it's a good idea to get rid of it. You can also leave comments on Twitter, and we'll be checking that at State of Bay. So, Grace, I hope that is a good overview of the issue.
That was a really good overview, Ethan. I feel super informed about that. I want to see if we've got Nico or Chris. Nico, are you on? I think we still don't have Nico's sound. How about you, Chris? We still can't hear Chris either. So hold on one second. I just have one question to somebody who – oh, Nico, are you there? Nope. As somebody who lives
– I can hear –
Oh, great. Nico Savage, welcome to COVID Radio. This is what happens when everybody's broadcasting from home. Thanks to you and our listeners for moving along with us. So Ethan got us a nice overview of where the 980 is and what the issues are. But tell us a little bit, Nico, about the history of the 980. I think it's the shortest freeways in California. How did it come to be?
Sure. And yeah, great to finally be with you. So the 980 freeway, if you go all the way back, it was originally envisioned as a route to a second Bay Bridge. So soon after the Bay Bridge opens, pretty quickly people want to start building another one. 980 is envisioned as it's going to be this route that takes you down to another Bay Bridge farther south. And that would be, you know, part of the route. Well, those plans that come up in the 1940s kind of fall apart. But by the 1970s, there's a new idea. Oakland wants to build a huge shopping center in what is now the city center area in downtown Oakland. You know, great big regional destination that would bring people in from all over, you know, would even have a an off-ramp that would go directly from the freeway to the parking garage, which a lot of Oakland residents noted meant, you know, the people from anywhere else in the Bay Area wouldn't even have to drive their cars on Oakland streets. And so by the 1970s, that's the vision that is driving the desire to build what we now know of as Interstate 980. That shopping center never happens either, but the freeway does get built, and it winds up, a two-mile connector between Highway 24 and Highway 580 at the northern end, and linking those at the southern end to Interstate 880.
And Nico, I appreciate that history, and I gave a little bit of geographical context while we're having those audio difficulties. But I'm curious, how utilized is this freeway? You know, who would be opposed to changing it back to a surface street or converting it to a surface street, and who was in favor of it?
Sure. So before the pandemic, on a busy day, Caltrans said that freeway would get about 117,000 cars. It's a decent amount of cars. So to give you an idea of who might use it, if you live in North Oakland in the Temescal area, or maybe if you live in parts of Berkeley, like I did when I was growing up, if we drove to a A's game, we would take Interstate 980 to go to Interstate 880. Similar if you are coming from areas on the Highway 24 corridor, like Walnut Creek or Lafayette or Orinda, if you're kind of coming down through the Caldecott Tunnel and going to, say, Jacqueline and Square or downtown Oakland or the Oakland Airport, you know, 980 is probably going to be the route that you would take to do that. So you might hear some opposition from those drivers.
Well, Chris, I wanted to turn to you. You founded a group called Connect Oakland that wants to take down the 980, and as we've been talking about, return those streets to the neighborhood. Tell me what Connect Oakland is doing.
Connect Oakland, in 2014, we founded Connect Oakland to just really bring the idea of reconnecting West Oakland to downtown with a detailed look at the possibilities and what could come out of that. Since then, it's been really taken up by the city of Oakland with their downtown plan. What we are doing right now is, we're on call to support the city in any way possible. And we're looking to how you can build the right type of coalition around the project and trying to outline a framework for social equity and environmental justice.
And Nico, I had to have to ask you about this because we hear about infrastructure. We heard about Infrastructure Week during the Trump years, and now we're hearing about the infrastructure bill with that President Biden is pushing. And when we think of infrastructure, we think of building things. But in this case, in a way, we're tearing something down. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to kind of where the politics are aligning on this. You know, we just heard from Chris that City of Oakland is moving forward. Where does the state and federal government fit into this? What's the political situation going on with this project?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like you mentioned, you know, the conversation around infrastructure used to look at it, a conversation from something like a State Department of Transportation really used to focus on where can we build a freeway? Where can we bolster and add more to our car infrastructure? But in the case of you know, the initial $2.3 trillion infrastructure package that the Biden administration rolled out, that includes $20 billion for that would fund projects to, and I'm quoting here, reconnect neighborhoods cut off by historic investments, which someone like Chris would say is exactly what happened with Interstate 980. So you have that pot of federal money potentially. Now, obviously, the Biden administration would have to get that through Congress, and there's been some issues on that front. But there's also a big federal highways bill that could include some of this money. You've seen Democratic senators introduce legislation to basically create a federal grant program to fund it. And as Chris mentioned, you know, you've got the city of Oakland in the form of its planning documents and its mayor's office supporting this vision and saying, yeah, we want to get rid of this freeway, turn it back into a surface street. Caltrans, so then at the state level, we've done federal and local. Caltrans is now engaged, you know, doing a study of Interstate 980's future. That's going to look at a whole bunch of things from, you know, the more modest changes, smaller changes, like making some pedestrian or bike improvements in the area, all the way up to the stuff that Connect Oakland is talking about, completely converting it and turning it into a boulevard.
Chris, I wanted to talk about that, pick up that piece on rectifying historical harms and how taking down 980 could possibly do that. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, so the great thing about 980 and reconstructing it is you have an opportunity to build back what was lost. And that includes reconnecting 12 city streets that were disconnected from West Oakland to downtown, and also repairing blocks and creating new city blocks or returning city blocks that were once there. And that could represent as much as 17 net new acres of land. And what's really important here is that's 17 net new acres that is hopefully the city of Oakland's. And so it should really represent what the city needs, and they can really set the agenda for that.
And I wanted to ask you too, Chris, about opposition here and what you would say to people that say, look, this is going to mean a lot more traffic, you know, coming through surface streets. It's going to back traffic up. I mean, imagine if this proposal gets legs, you're going to be hearing a lot more of that as people who are, you know, used to the convenience of 980 getting upset about what they might be losing. What would be your response to those concerns?
Well, it's twofold. First is if the corridor is used as a second approach to a tunnel, a second transbay tunnel, it can move a lot more people than a freeway. And second is most of Oakland City streets are actually underutilized. I think that's been proved in the downtown plan. And the historic, whether it's the Embarcadero or Octavia in San Francisco, the traffic disperses. But our proposal of a multi-way boulevard also can move a great amount of traffic.
Chris, let me just follow up with you on that. I mean, you mentioned how this might impact with a second transbay tunnel. Could you describe a bit about how that long-term vision would fit into removing the 980 freeway?
Yeah, so back in 2015, MTC started the core capacity study. It has now moved on and is called Link 21. And they are studying in the next, I think, year and a half, two alternatives for a second transbay tunnel, one on that would follow Webster, and the other option is 980. And so that could be everything from Caltrain, Amtrak, BART, high-speed rail, all coming through Oakland in the future.
Well, Nico, with our last question of this segment, I wanted to ask you, it's all kind of hypothetical at the moment, so what are next steps to make the idea a reality?
That's a good question, and Chris, jump in if I miss anything. But I think you would need to, you know, find a way to secure the funding that would have to go into you know, converting this freeway into something different. There's that Caltrans study that I mentioned that could, you know, go a long way in determining what the state wants to do with that land. But otherwise, Chris, let me know if I'm forgetting anything as far as what might be happening next year, other than, you know, watching to see these infrastructure package negotiations in Congress.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the biggest things is, I don't know who the responsible party for this would be, but it's to really develop a collaborative stakeholder structure. You know, there are a lot of big players in this game, and, you know, we need to develop political power that's autonomous and inclusive to all those around the freeway, and really begin to develop metrics for success and values to judge any future potential of 980 as something different.
And Chris, just in a number here, what would be your prediction if all goes well when we would actually see this happen in terms of tearing down the 980 here?
Oh, I'm an urban planner by trade, so I would say on a aggressive schedule, 5 to 8 years, more likely a decade plus.
All right. Well, it gives us time here on State of the Bay to cover this issue again. I want to thank Chris Sensenig of Connect Oakland, Nico Savage of the East Bay Times for joining us on State of the Bay. Apologize for the audio difficulties, but it was great to have you both on. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Next up, we talk to Gary Camilla about the spirits of San Francisco and whether loving San Francisco's physical beauty is enough to get people to stay. That's right after the break. According to author Gary Camilla, barring some unforeseen and cataclysmic event, San Francisco will be his home for the rest of his life. He was born in Oakland, grew up in Berkeley, and headed over the bridge in 1971 and has been in San Francisco ever since. He calls it his favorite place in the world.
And Camilla was the co-founder of Salon.com and until 2018 served as the executive editor of San Francisco Magazine, where he oversaw coverage and wrote stories on every major city story from legalizing marijuana to homelessness and, of course, tech.
Camilla is the author of Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco, and he also writes the column Portals of the Past for the San Francisco Chronicle.
His latest book is Spirits of San Francisco, Voyages Through the Unknown City. He also wrote the introduction and contributed an essay in the newly published anthology, The End of the Golden Gate, which features works from Bay Area writers and luminaries such as Margaret Cho, W. Kamau Bell, who's heard here on KALW, and Daniel Handler of Lemony Snicket fame.
And to our listeners, what's your favorite part of living in San Francisco? What's a place off the beaten track that you want to share?
We'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay, where you can leave a comment or a question.
Well, Gary Camilla, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks, Grace. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're so excited. Your audio is good, too. So,
great.
I want to start. Both of your books, Spirits of San Francisco and this anthology that you contributed to, The End of the Golden Gate, they came out during the pandemic. And you wrote in the introduction to Spirits of San Francisco, you wrote that in May 2020, that when we were just when we were wrapping our heads around sheltering in place. And I wonder, what was the early days of quarantine like for you?
Well, as I wrote in the introduction, it was actually a kind of a euphoric experience for me. Part of that was a personal reason. I had just had one of my already replaced knees re-replaced, which was not something I was really banking on after only 10 years. But you know, I think the technology has gotten even better. So it was effective. But I was, you know, right when I came back to San Francisco, I was recuperated for the first week or two at my mother's house in Berkeley. And when I got back to San Francisco, that was right when, you know, the shelter in place order of London Bridge shelter in place order had come down. And so that was at that very moment, I was beginning my sort of baby steps, trying out my knee and walking through the streets. And so for me, as I say in the introduction, it was quite euphoric because I was healing and I was getting better and feeling stronger. And then as a longtime lover of San Francisco and an urbanist and lover of the streets in all of their strangeness, This was the strangest, you know, almost a psychedelic experience of being in San Francisco. It was like, you know, being in, you know, the world's biggest flash mob where they everyone said, we will not go onto the streets for X number of days. So, and I just loved that. I loved sort of owning the streets and wandering through them by myself, of course, well aware of the gravity of the situation and of the fact that we were in a global pandemic. I wasn't like, you know, Caligula or Nero playing my, you know, solipsistic fiddle while people died. I knew how terrible it was. But at the same time, there I was in my city wandering the streets. And it was quite thrilling in many ways, I have to say.
Well, certainly that was one of the upsides of the pandemic, I think, for a lot of people. That gave them a chance to really kind of rediscover where we are, where we live, our local city here. And in Spirits of San Francisco, you've subtitled it Voyages Through the Unknown City. And I'm wondering, Gary, if you ended up rediscovering any places during the pandemic or finding new places. I mean, I think of you as the consummate expert on every nook and cranny of San Francisco. So I'm wondering what was new to Gary Camilla during the pandemic and walking around.
Oh boy. Yeah. I mean, I have to say I discover something new just about every time I walk out. And sometimes that's because I'm doing it. Like if I'm walking in downtown San Francisco, which I do with a buddy who used to be the head of the geography department at UC Berkeley, Michael Johns, and we'll walk out with this fantastic book called Splendid Survivors, Michael Corbett's book from the 70s, which ranks every historical downtown building. So walking in the deep heart of downtown and having this, you know, really erudite guide to everything you're seeing, that's a great way of just seeing everything anew. Architecture really needs footnotes in a way. And unless you're really an expert when you're walking through looking at downtown buildings, it really helps to have an expert like telling you what you're looking at, who built it, you know, what was the style, what were the, you know, what was the whole milieu, the architectural milieu that it came up in. So that's one thing. But yeah, I discovered all kinds of odd alleys and, you know, strange natural places that I hadn't seen before, as I always do. So and the pandemic certainly encouraged that because it encouraged you know, me to walk maybe even more than I had before.
Well, I'm a big history nerd, so I just gobbled this book up. And one of my favorite stories was a history of Chinatown, which, you know, I've walked through a bunch of times. But in your book, you're right, the community leaders got together after the 1906 earthquake and wanted to make it a little less vice-oriented. And they commissioned a bunch of white architects to make it look more like a Chinese village. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was a fascinating episode in the city's history. Of the white city fathers had been wanting to get rid of Chinatown almost from the moment that it began in the 1850s, starting out around Sacramento Street. You know, it was just perceived, part of it was just blatant racism. Mm. It was perceived as filthy and dangerous, and very dangerous fumes were coming up. You know, there was all of these kind of myths about underground tunnels. And it really was a pretty vice-filled place in the late 19th century. The Tong Wars were bloody and violent. And, you know, there were opium dens. There was all kinds of exaggerations and racism involved. But the place was definitely had its, you know, its seamy side. And so the city fathers had been like, you know, pounding away to try to get rid of it. And after the earthquake, they saw this golden opportunity to do it. And they actually tried. It was incredibly enough, including very progressive leaders like Mayor Phelan, who, despite being progressive, was extremely racist, both against Chinese and Japanese. And, you know, he you know, the mayor and Abe Ruoff, the notorious, you know, corrupt advisor to Mayor Schmitz, they formed this very high level committee on the relocation of Chinatown. And they wanted to just use the opportunity of it being destroyed in the earthquake to move it out to, guess where? Hunter's Point, a traditional dumping ground for city's undesirables. and for undesirable industries. It had butchers and, you know, and that sort of thing out there. So actually it became an international incident. The Chinese government got involved. Chinese leaders flexed their muscles and, you know, basically said, no, we're not leaving. And the courts repeatedly ruled against the city. You know, they were like, no, if people own this land, you can't simply make them leave because you don't like this neighborhood for whatever reasons. But one of the things that the Chinese leaders did in order to, like, sort of ingratiate themselves and all, and there was a genuine sense that the old Chinatown wasn't what you know, the leaders of Chinatown, the six families and the important notables of Chinatown were like, well, the old Chinatown, which did attract some tourists for vice and, you know, a little bit of restaurants, but there were very few Chinese restaurants before the earthquake. It was much more like anyone going there from the outside was going there for vice. And the vice itself had gotten out of control. The Tang Wars had gotten out of control. And so one of the things that they decided to do that, and the main thing they decided to do was to rebrand it and recreate it as this kind of oriental fairyland. And Chinatown before the earthquake did not look like Chinatown does now. It was actually a fairly prosaic, wasn't colorful. It didn't have all these things that they call chinoiserie, you know, this kind of Chinese style architectural details. It just looked like kind of a slightly more exotic, you know, dumpy San Francisco neighborhood. And so the Chinese notables hired these white architects to create this Asian fairyland using traditional Chinese techniques, but created like a Potemkin village in actual Chinese architecture. All of those, you know, pagodas and eaves and corbels and ornamental wrought iron, those actually have structural functions. In Chinatown, they're completely just pasted on. They don't hold anything up. They're just there to look like it's Chinese. And one of the fascinating things about Chinatown at this point is that you can walk through it and have this kind of almost epistemological conversation with yourself. Like, is this authentically Chinese or not? Because it's not in a way, but it's now so old that it's sort of lovable in its weird Disneyland-like way. And so it's become like a second order real place. So it's a fascinating story. And it has actually, you know, worked really well because the rebranding worked. It made Chinatown family friendly. It made it much more of an attractive destination. And that coincided with the fading out of the Tang Wars, of the sex slavery that had been a terrible, awful thing in Chinatown for decades. A lot of the vices, the opium dens, all of that went away. And the Chinatown that we know today essentially replaced it, and it was much more commercially successful.
Well, Gary, whether or not it's authentically Chinese, I think Chinatown is definitely authentically San Francisco, given this, I think, pretty eye-opening history. You wonder how many people have wandered through Chinatown just assuming this is, you know, authentic cultural representation of China. So it's just one of the many fascinating stories in your articles that you write in the Chronicle and in the book as well. And if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco. We are joined by Gary Camilla, author of Spirits of San Francisco and a contributor to the anthology End of the Golden Gate. We would love to hear from you. Have you played tourist in your own town here in San Francisco or other spots around the Bay? What's a place you might recommend to visit? You can join the program by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on Twitter at State of Bay. We'd love to hear from you. Well, Gary, we were talking about infrastructure before you joined, and one of the things that really stood out to me about your book was how much the geographic layout of the city, specifically the hills, the steep grades, really affected the history of the place and the people who lived here. I mean, even the mud from the story of the Mission Plank Road coming over to downtown from the Mission District. But I was wondering if you could share the story about Andrew Hallady, the inventor of the cable car, and what led him to even consider the idea.
Yes. So Andrew Hallady was a Scottish immigrant who had acquired great skill in manufacturing wire cables in the Sierra. to carry gold, you know, in gondolas. And he had begun thinking about the possibility of, you know, using that in some other way. But what happened to him was actually an awful sight that he witnessed as he walked actually sort of the edge of Chinatown, near North Beach and Chinatown, around Kearney and Jackson Street on a rainy day. He witnessed a team of horses trying to pull a coach up the Jackson Street grade. And the horses slipped on the slippery surface and slid backwards. And a couple of the horses were very seriously hurt. And, you know, he saw this and he was horrified as he watched this this awful incident. And he vowed to himself, you know, I'm going to see if I can do something so this kind of thing won't happen anymore, this terrible tragedy to these animals. And so he came up with this incredibly audacious idea that his wire rope, as they call it, the cable, instead of going in the air as it had in the gold country, he had the idea of running it underground. And, you know, everyone laughed at him, and it was called Halliday's Folly, and he couldn't raise the money. He had to mortgage his house. You know, he put everything on the line, but he knew what he was doing. He was an incredibly talented engineer with a real drive. He became one, you know, after he invented it, he became one of San Francisco's leading citizens. But he, you know, he got the money. He got the investment. He created the first line up the Clay Street Hill, of the Fern Street Hill, as Knob Hill was called also at that time. And, you know, early in the morning, he summoned a crew to go up to the top of the hill where he had this little cable car up there, the very world's very first cable car on top of the hill. And he had a veteran train a locomotive engineer who was going to take it down the hill. And this guy took one look. He looks down at Clay and Jones, which, as anyone who's been on top of Knob Hill and looks down Clay and Jones, it's pretty steep. And it goes, yeah, it's steep for about five blocks. You know, it goes from Jones as the summit, and it doesn't bottom out until you get to Kearney. And each one of those blocks drops down a significant amount. And this guy looks down. He's like, nope, I'm not doing this. So Halliday, though, was made of sterner stuff. And he just, you know, stepped in and, you know, attached the cable to, you know, to the grip. And that, you know, that's the secret. The secret sauce of cable cars is that grip mechanism that holds the cable car to the wire, to the rope. And, you know, and then he then rolled down the hill with the cable car attached to the rope and, you know, turned around at the bottom, came back up. And when they were done, there's a lovely kind of a note. He notes that there was no drinking. Of course, it was like 6 a.m, so it would have been kind of hard to drink a lot, although in San Francisco, that would have not been that unusual. But, you know, he says, we just shook hands and had cold water. But then later in the day, they had a big party, and the whole town got pretty drunk to celebrate this this incredible event. There's a charming story that it was all men, of course. San Francisco being a typical American, you know, 19th century city, all the men were going around in this cable car. And on the initial, what was called a revenue run, they had to make this run, and, you know, in order to be a legal paying public transportation device. And this one woman, a young woman, was like following after the cable car for like several blocks trying to get on. And finally, some chivalrous men allowed her to get on, and she fished a nickel out of her purse and put it into the coin collector's, you know, purse and said, now I can say that I was the first woman ever to ride a cable car. It's a sweet story.
I wish it still cost a nickel.
I know. It's the most, speaking of transportation infrastructure, it is the most expensive public form of transit in the United States. It's basically a Disneyland ride, yeah, but it's so much fun that, you know people don't mind. It's, I don't know, it's $7 now, or I haven't even looked at what the fare is lately, but it's really expensive. But, you know, people don't mind.
I always tell people to take the California one because it's a little less crowded. flooded, and that view down from the top down to Chinatown is pretty spectacular. So
yeah, that's a nice recommendation. It's a different type of cable car. It's a longer, heavier cable car on the California line, and then you get the thrill of when you're on the California line and you cross Powell Street. There's that little guy in that kiosk there, and that's the one manual crossing place where there's still a human being that's controlling the crossing there. So it's all of the lines are great there, but the California one is, yeah, you're right. The California line is the one that's used by the most San Franciscans.
Yeah.
If you live in Pacific Heights and you work in the financial district, bingo. You know, you can actually walk to the cable car and go to work that way.
Yeah. So. The only bummer is when you go toward on the west side and you end up on Van Ness, it's sort of a wah-wah, you know. It's not such a great destination.
It ends at Van Ness. It's not – it doesn't quite go up into Pacific Heights.
Right. Say that history repeats itself. And when it – I think that's kind of true when it comes to South of Market. I was sort of fascinated by this story that you had. Like, you call that area – at one point it was like Hobo. Bohemia or Hobo.
Yeah, Hobohemia, right.
Hobohemia. And then it just in the 20s and 30s, you know, probably because of the economy, becomes kind of a skid row. And in some ways, I would want to use that term to describe that area now because people live there. But it is a place that, you know, has perpetually been difficult in the sense of like people are living hard lives there. Why is it that place? Is there something about that area or it's just history?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, obviously, Grace, the only part of South of Market where there's much of a skid row or, you know, a really tough area is the area around 6th and 7th and Mission. It doesn't, you know, it used to be was all this big working class neighborhood. And then, as you point out, during when it fell in hard times, it was pretty gritty through much of the whole geographic area of what we now think of South of Market. It's a much smaller area now. It's almost more like just an extension of the Tenderloin South of Market. But that's a really interesting question, why, you know, it started out as a working class neighborhood. And I think the main reason was a lot of it was geography. At a certain point, wealthy people, and this didn't happen right away, it took a number of decades, actually, wealthy people started to move on to the hills the way they do in most places for the views and the, you know, kind of getting away from industry. South of Market was a natural place because it was flat to locate a lot of industry. And so, you know, it was relatively close to downtown. It was pretty easy. There was the public transit was going through there. So it made sense that in the 19th century, when the industries began to spring up, that a lot of them sprang up south of Market. It was right, you know, flat and close to things with decent transportation and actually with water nearby. And that was, you know, back, it's scandalous and awful. But, you know, this is how all cities were in the 19th century. We just dumped everything into the bay. You know, there was like the water was limitless. You know, human beings were just, they could throw anything in there. Nobody cared.
Right.
You know, you just dump blood, guts, paint, you know, toxic substances. Hey, there's some water that'll get rid of it all. And so that was convenient because remember, Mission Bay was far more extensive than it is now. You know, the water came way up to Harrison Street. And, you know, there are marshes around Folsom and Harrison. So there was a lot of industries down there near the water that was convenient for them. So, and then once it became industrial, that drove away the aristocratic neighborhoods. That the very first aristocratic neighborhoods in San Francisco were both down south of Market, South Park and Rincon Hill. But as industry was one of the big things, it was actually ironic that most of the people living in those aristocratic neighborhoods had made their fortunes on the industries that grew up south of Market. But then when those industries took over too much, they drove these people out of their, you know, ritzy houses. So, yeah. So a lot of it was just the fact that, you know, working class people moved in there because it was less desirable, it was cheaper, and the wealthy people had left. And it became a very huge working class area. And then, you know, as we got later into the 19th century, racism and, you know, social prejudices led forced people of color often to move into areas that had actually once been very wealthy and sort of upper class white areas, South Park and around Rincon Hill as well. So there was a big Filipino community in South Park. One of the early Japan towns was there. There was a black population in South Park in the 1920s and 30s. So this was an indication, you know, because of the racism and bigotry of the time, that this was not a, you know, this was not considered a good neighborhood. And then there was this kind of lovely part of its history that you point out when you talk about Hobohemia. That one of my favorite little strange episodes of San Francisco history really is the heyday of the hobos. And hobos were different from homeless people today. You know, society was different. It was a different time. Many of them worked. They drank, but many did not. In their heyday, they didn't necessarily like drink till they fell down on the ground. They were like sort of drinking for fun. There was this kind of, you know, male there. None of them had families. Some of them had families elsewhere, but none of them had families with them. There was that whole hopping the train culture. There was seasonal work. And around Third and Mission, Fourth and Howard, there was all of these places catered to this enormous vagrant transient population that would come into town and then go work in the fields, work in the canneries, work as fruit pickers, and you know, would they'd have their stuff stored in these, you know, cheap hotels, and they would kind of look after them, and they'd come into town with like a $20 steak. For some reason, the economics of hobos were such whenever they came into San Francisco during the winter, they had like $20. And the, like, you know, that was enough to last them through, you know, the winter.
$20 definitely won't get you very far in San Francisco these days. So it's definitely an earlier time. And Gary, I wanted to ask you about, we got a listener comment on this as well, but at the school renaming, because you go through a lot of the history of naming and some of the questionable characters that streets were named after. So what is your opinion on the whole school renaming controversy that's sort of gripped the city recently?
No, I think it's completely ridiculous. I think it's a colossal waste of time. Yes, there are probably, you know, one or two egregious people that no one, you know, no school should be named after. But I just find this all, frankly, ridiculous. We have so many enormous real problems to deal with. And this is almost a way of avoiding dealing with them and, you know, striking a pose of righteousness. And frankly, you know, when you look at what they did, the striking the pose of righteousness was often based on completely ridiculous and shoddy historical research that doesn't even make any sense. So and in a larger sense, once you look at historical figures like Abraham Lincoln and George Washington, everyone's got feet of clay. You know, so the idea that you're going to like rename Abraham Lincoln High School because Abraham Lincoln had some flawed policies towards Native people, which he did. Once you go down that road, no one will be left. So I just find this, you know, an example of kind of virtue signaling and posing that doesn't actually improve the lot of people of color or of people with less privileges. And it's just it's very symbolic. And I think it's really silly, frankly.
Well, you're a busy guy, Gary, and you've also contributed an essay to this newly published anthology, which is the full title is The End of the Golden Gate, Writers on Loving and Sometimes Leaving San Francisco. And one theme that I picked up from the book is what I used to hear when I first moved to the city in 89 is, you missed it. The good times in San Francisco are over. You're too late. And it's just the golden time is relative, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, people have been saying that literally since the gold rush. You know, people were like, God, you know, back in the days of the Californios, before all the gringos poured in, those were the golden days. And then, you know, after that, what you can just choose your decade. There was always a time before that when the real men or the real women and the real artists, and it was cheaper and it was more bohemian, and it goes on and on. Now, having said that, there's no denying that there are moments in the history of every city when there's bigger changes that take place and that cannot be denied. I mean, I've lived here 50 years, and the tech invasion that is has particularly exercised so many people is no question was the biggest sort of demographic and economic change in a short period of time, certainly that I've seen in that 50 years. So I'm not trying to deny the reality that that happened, or what, and I understand why people were very exercised by it. But if you take a long view, you know, it is one, just one of a number of pretty significant changes that have hit the city.
Well, and Gary, a lot of your writers really have a love-hate relationship in terms of their feelings about San Francisco. Some of them have left the city. Some of them have come back. But, you know, you pretty admirably write that you're never leaving the San Francisco. You're a long hauler, not in the COVID sense, but in the San Francisco sense. Right. And I'm just wondering why you're holding out in San Francisco. What is it about that the city that grabs you?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Ethan. I mean, everybody's got their own city that they live in, and everybody's city is a different place. If you're somebody, and younger people are more like this, if you're your city is specifically or primarily in your eyes a social environment, and you're what strikes you about it is the nature of your crowd, of how your crowd can survive, of who's in the city, of what you perceive to be the dominant demographics of the city, and that's driving your feeling for the city. Then if you're like a punk rocker or a language poet, or you're engaged in any creative enterprise that doesn't make money. Now, you could even be engaged in a creative process that makes some money, but not enough money to pay $3,000 a month rent. Now it's a little bit cheaper, but that was the old, rent, but it's not that much cheaper now. If you're in that headspace, then yes, I can really understand why you would want to leave, because you're not living in a city that is predominantly a physical place. You're living in a city that is predominantly a social space. And for me, the city I live in is both, but the physical place is huge for me. And partly it's because I'm older. I live alone. I, have lots of friends, but I enjoy just walking through the city and just looking at it. The physical beauty of San Francisco for me, because of just who I am and how long I've been here, is really the predominant thing. And I wander around and it's stunning. It's stunning every day. And in a way that there are very few cities in the world, and I've traveled to many, many beautiful cities in the world, and there are very few that are as physically stunning as San Francisco. It's a very short list. You know, you're talking about Hong Kong, but which is far more overcrowded and urban, Istanbul, Rio, Sydney, and all of, you could put San Francisco above all of those in certain ways because for its terrain. Not Rio's would be probably the one exception, but when I was in Rio, I got robbed 5 times. So, there was that. But it's an amazing physical, no one in their right mind would deny that. And so it really comes down to, what city do you inhabit? What sort of part of your brain is being activated? And sometimes the demographic changes of San Francisco can be irritating. There are moments when it feels like, oh, this has become like, kind of Houston West or whatever. But, I am able to adjust to that.
Well, I think it can be all summed up with a line from one of your essays, which is, at every step, San Francisco offers you the universe for free. So thanks so much for sharing your love for San Francisco with us, Gary Camilla, and please come back. We loved it.
No, thank you very much, Grace and Ethan. It was a pleasure being on the show.
All right. Well, next up, we're going to hear Grace's interview with poet Giovanna Lomanto. So stick around on State of the Bay.
Say gold digger like it's a bad thing, as if your ancestors didn't come to California to find the yellow in the dirt, and the tag on your shirt still says made in my motherland. Fine refers to the melanin of Indonesian skin crackling, quote, China, unquote, in your grandma's cabinet. Still calls me oriental rug to walk over and talk over. And did I tell you that my family lost my Chinese name? We'll never know how my grandmother wanted the world to welcome me, never feel the sweet caress of syllables intended for my tongue at every introduction, at every family function, gold digger, and believe that it's family. When I say family, I mean more than my blood. My family is the Chinatown streets, the laundromat drying your sheets, the elders dying at your feet. Look at them. Look at them and look at all the people we have stepped on, over, into, around, and to all my black brothers and sisters standing, screaming, fighting for me through tears, so ready to finally see that the honey comes from the bees, the black and the yellow, the loud and the mellow, drowning in the gold rush. God forbid the waters that brought us here don't sift us through the screens, bottle us up to put on 24 karat shelves. What good is your grandma's china closet if porcelain will shatter when you ask us one more time where we come from? Come from wayfarers, plate sharers, never to be found weight bearers. Come from the sway, come from the bay, come from the hard work or no glory type of way. Deep in the earth, hunger and thirst, family first, see the sweat dripping off our backs in past lives. Call us golden, eroded in the afternoon sun, but it's morning now, and it's time we were reborn.
Giovanna Lomanto, thank you for sharing your super powerful poem, Gold Digger. Tell me a little bit about the inspiration behind it.
Yeah, I wrote that for a photo shoot, actually, that was for Stop Asian Hate and Black Lives Matter. And I was asked to write that poem to read as a poem prayer before the shoot. And so I prayed to the poem gods and was like, please bless me with this poem prayer too.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in it, and you're focusing on themes of family and racial justice. What messages were you trying to send?
I grew up in Sacramento for the most part, born in the Bay, but grew up in Sacramento. So I was really thinking about the gold rush particularly, and was thinking about like the Transcontinental Railroad and all of the Asian labor that has gone into building this country. And then also thinking about how the recent increase in AAPI, hate crimes and targeted violence, are making me think very differently about Black Lives Matter, which is in a way very terrible, but it really was a reframing, and it was kind of me saying, I need to be both a better ally to my community and to a community that is desperately in need of allies right now.
I mean, how has this time been for you and your family with all the increase in anti-Asian and violence? And how have you been coping with the concerns that you might have for your family or friends?
Yeah, I definitely have felt the impact. For instance, I have a grandpa who lives in Indonesia, and I called him, and the first thing he said to me was, don't leave your house. And I was very confused. I was like, oh, yeah, no, like, I'm fully vaccinated. Like, I should be okay. I'm just going to work mostly. And he was like, where do you work? And I'm like, oh, I work by, like, Old Oakland Chinatown. He was like, that's scary. And he started talking about all of the hate crimes and the violence. And to think that he's thinking that all the way in Indonesia is really quite something. My mom, if she calls me and I'm like, oh, I'm eating dinner at a park with a friend right now, she'll be like, why are you out? And it's never for COVID reasons that she's worried anymore. The fear has kind of shifted, and she's had to like sit me down a couple times and be like, you can't be walking home alone, even if it's like two blocks, you know, like it's really scary nowadays.
Another cool thing about Gold Digger, which the listeners have heard it and how powerful it is, but it's a visual document as much as it is an oral one.
It kind of comes out in chunks when you read it on the page. There's some that's left aligned, some that's right aligned, and there's some that are center aligned and some that look like paragraphs rather than like poem lines. And a lot of times I write it in a way that I want it to be seen on a page rather than heard. And so when I'm writing Gold Digger, I especially wanted to
have a lot of fragmentation just because there's so much pieciness to identity, and there's so much about being Asian that is really about coming from this like mix of cultures. And especially for immigrants like me and my family, I'm not an immigrant, but my family immigrated from Indonesia. And I think that one of the spacings that really sticks out to me is the word China. Each letter is its individual line. And I kind of wanted to draw that out just because, for one, it's very much a part of my heritage to be focusing on China. But it's also like that piece of me that is Chinese is so far away from the piece of me that is Indonesian and the piece of me that is American because of the way that ancestry kind of works and migration works. And so that moment, for instance, was just me saying, like, I really want to have this white space because I really want to think about all the ways that I don't actually know how to be Chinese. And then there's like a huge block at the very end of the poem that's just like a huge chunky paragraph. And I thought that I really wanted that to be read breathlessly and to just run through it. And it's like an onslaught of emotion and wordage. And so I just clumped it all together and made it one big chunk.
And when you deliver the poem, when you think about doing that performative piece, how do you decide what's a word to emphasize, where to put in a little more intensity? Is that just inherently part of the piece and you recite it the same every single time? Or do you go as the spirit moves you?
I definitely go as the spirit moves me. I feel like every time that I read the poem, it sounds a little bit different. Trying to read it in different voices. For instance, I have like what my friend calls my radio voice, which I suppose is this voice, in which I'm just talking. There's another voice that I use where you can like hear me smile in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And when I'm reading poetry at a university reading, I'll read with one of those voices. But I was particularly drawn to spoken word because it was created for a performance, for that photo shoot. And so I was like, what if I just used my, like, slam poet voice and really, like, took that on? And then that's kind of where it ended up going. And I don't think that I have ever had the skill of being able to hone it down and have, like, a single tone that will just stay every single time I perform a piece. Once again, I think that that's a great and beautiful thing about poetry, is that it'll come to you in a different way every time.
Absolutely. Well, you have a new book of poetry coming out called Jupiter Fell Out of the Sky Last Night. When does your book come out, and what's something about it that you're excited about?
Yes, Jupiter, as I like to call her. Jupiter comes out in July. So July 13th is when all of the pre-orders are going to ship out. And I'm really excited about this book because it's the second collection I've published through a traditional publishing route. And the first collection that I published was very much the teen angst poems. It was very much like me kind of coming out of high school, freshman year of college, having a really difficult time adjusting. And that was also before I studied poetry. And so I was just kind of like purely emoting. I ended up publishing that and being really proud of it for about 3 months. Then I took more poetry classes and found out, like, oh, there's actually other ways to approach language than the ways that I previously knew. But I'm excited for No Body in Particular, which is my first collection, to not be the only body of work I have out. I'm super proud of Jupiter, and a lot of it came from classes I've taken, workshops I've taken, and it's just been so wonderful to just continue learning about ways that you can invoke emotion through writing. And I guess what I'm most excited for, besides just having a different slate, is also just hearing which poems resonated with people most. And I always really love hearing what struck people and what didn't. So,
well, we look forward to the book of poetry, and I hope that there's an opportunity for us to see you perform live or on Zoom in the future. Giovanna Lomanto, it's such a pleasure to have you on State of the Bay. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Grace's interview with poet Giovanna Lomanto. She recently graduated from UC Berkeley and was mentored by Youth Speaks, a free arts education organization, and her new book of poetry, Jupiter Fell Out of the Sky, will be published this July. And that's State of the Bay this week.
Thanks to all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation.
And Grace, I know we're off next week for Memorial Day, but if you have questions for our show 2 weeks from today, you can email us at stateofthebay@gmail.com. Tweet us. We're at State of Bay. Love to hear your ideas for future show topics that we can cover.
Yeah, and for a link to this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org.
Our engineer this evening was Dee Miner, and tonight's show was produced by my co-hosts Grace Wan and Wendy Holcomb.
I'm Grace Wan.
And I'm Ethan Elkind.
Good night, and thanks for listening.
Stay safe, everyone, and join us 2 weeks, Monday at 6:00.